So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review man.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Clippers are playing here in the World Wrestling Federation because we're only 2 weeks away from the World Wrestling Federation extravaganza, the pay-per-view known as SummerSlam, and that's when Lex Luger and Native American Tatanka will settle their score once and for all. More on that story later on tonight. However, tonight, we are live right here. Massachusetts at the Lowell Memorial Auditorium, and this is Monday Night Raw.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting, who is fresh back from a trip to New York. Welcome home, Wei.
Thanks, man. Wow. I mean, the trip was so quick. It was as if I'd never left.
Well, you were getting set to leave just right after we finished Raw on Monday night. So you were only there for what, 24 hours?
Yeah. It was very brief. Very brief. I don't even know. More than 24.
But did you get any time on your own to actually go around the city, or was it all working?
It was hard for me to remember, but I assume that I did. I can only assume that I did. Again, it was very brief, but I can only assume that I did, and I can only assume that I even had a chance to see some of her friends in New York, such as Court Bauer, Brian Mann, and Ahmad Butt.
Yes.
So.
And Paul Heyman.
He's not my friend.
No, I'm sure he's aware. I'm sure he's listening right now.
Yeah, I didn't see him. But yeah, good time. Great times hanging out. In fact, I made Brian Mann skip TNA. He was all set to go to the TNA show. And then I was like, hey, guys, I'm going to be in town. You guys want to grab a drink? And
He bailed on Impact.
Bailed on Impact. I felt terrible. In fact,
you're killing this company, Wei.
It is.
You're hurting their house.
It's all me. Yeah. Well, he managed to find somebody to take his ticket. So, I mean,
I find it amusing that you went to New York and you met up with Brian and Ahmad, where your connection is wrestling, and Impact is probably 15 minutes from where you guys are having your drink.
Mm-hmm.
You guys should have gone to Impact.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was not happening, was it?
No, I don't. No, not really, man. Because maybe if we were in, like, somewhere in, like, Kentucky.
Tokyo?
No.
If you were in Tokyo on Friday and didn't go to Cork and Hall?
No, if I was in Tokyo for one day, I don't think I would have done that either. Because if it was a city like Mississippi, whatever. What's a city in Mississippi?
Tupelo.
Tupelo. You know what?
Tupelo.
I don't even want to dismiss Tupelo, Mississippi, because it might be awesome. Like if I was in a place for maybe like a month, then yeah, okay, I'll sacrifice one of those nights. But this is New York City. It's the greatest city in the world, and to spend it an evening watching pro wrestling. It's not something I necessarily want to do. Even if it was something, that was like, if it was like a baseball game, I wouldn't be into that. I mean, I'm not really a baseball fan, but I'd just rather there's so many other things to life than just wrestling on that one night.
Well, that's a very balanced approach. Did you happen to?
Even if it was like a jiu-jitsu competition, I don't even know if I would have gone to a jiu-jitsu competition that evening.
This weekend, it's what you have called your WrestleMania. It's Metamoris this coming weekend. Are you planning to be watching this?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh. Where are you going to be watching it?
I think a bunch of people at Open Mat are probably going to figure out a place. Actually, there's going to be an Open Mat Beach Day earlier in the day. Will you be joining?
Well, I returned to Open Mat on Monday after, or on Tuesday, I mean, after a month away. And I certainly walked in with a bit of shame that I have not gone in the past month. So it's kind of like we're back on speaking terms, and I don't feel, I feel I would be imposing to come into Beach Day.
No, you wouldn't. It's a potluck. Just bring some food.
We'll see. Perhaps. When is this? This is on Saturday?
It's Saturday. Yeah, that's right. It's Saturday. We'll go to the beach. We'll eat. We'll show off our glistening bodies. And then
I'll wear my low-key bodysuit.
Okay. And then we'll watch Metamoris. It'll be fun.
Yeah, I do want to watch Metamoris.
Okay, well, at the very least, you should join for Metamoris. But I think you should come to the beach as well.
What was it like? Because the last Metamoris, you guys all watched it together. Is it different watching it with all of these BJJ practitioners? I mean, are you guys kind of like,
no.
Would it be like watching a movie with a bunch of aspiring directors?
You know, I can't really say that it was. Honestly, it just felt like it was, you were watching with just, it's like watching a UFC with your friends. It's the same thing, except, you know. Maybe there might be fewer people complaining about, you know, whoa, what's going on? I don't understand. I think most of the people watching knew what was happening. But, you know, I think it's largely the same. I don't even recall completely last time. I mean, the only match that really stood out to me was obviously the main event with Eddie and Hoyler. But beyond that, like, I can't say there are too many things that even stood out. But, you know, I think if this is successful, it would be great to see more, you know, popular MMA names, especially I'm thinking about people that no longer do MMA, like a George St. Pierre or even like a Randy Couture or something, to come in and still have that competitive experience in an event like this in the future.
Oh, I promise, folks, we're going to stop with the non-wrestling in just a second. But you bring up Randy Couture. Can I make a request, Way, that the two of us put aside 22 minutes and we chat about Gym Rescue when it debuts next week?
Absolutely. I want to watch this show.
There are a few shows I have looked more forward to than this. This looks like the ultimate train wreck show, and I very much want to watch this. This is a Spike TV reality show, which for those of you that never saw Quentin Jackson's reality show, you have no idea what you're in store for. But Gym Rescue, I believe it's this weekend it debuts. I'm pretty sure. So maybe next Monday on Raw.
Why wouldn't they debut it after Bellator or before Bellator or even after TNA?
That's a great question. I don't have the exact date on let's see when it is. That would make the most sense. But for some reason in my head, I thought it was starting on the weekend, which is a very curious move. You would think they would want to put on Impact. That, again, the value of Impact right there. August 10th at 9 p.m. So that means they're start Sunday night at 10. Or at 9 p.m. it debuts. It's a 3-episode reality series.
Okay.
So maybe next Sunday night, there's no pay-per-view. Everyone sit back and watch Gym Rescue featuring Randy Couture and Frank Shamrock as they go and try to save gyms. And sometimes come to violent blows with the gym owner when gym owner does not take criticism too well.
Well, that's how they should be rescuing these gyms, is to actually physically attack the owner.
Yeah, then it turns into human rescue.
Yeah. you know, just the idea of Randy Couture I was about to say Frank Couture. Which is,
that's what they should be collectively known here as they go from gym to gym. They're just Frank Couture. Yeah,
Frank Couture. The idea of just these two men partaking in a reality show and yelling at people, yelling at like these innocent, defenseless, you know, Midwestern, maybe, I don't know, gym owners from Tupelo, Mississippi. I find that very amusing.
From Tupelo.
Yeah.
Didn't you recently get to hang out with Frank Shamrock? He would be a friend.
Yeah. Yeah, we did, actually. We went down to LA and we actually shot you know, like a half hour kind of biographical type of interview with I keep wanting to say Frank Couture now. Frank Shamrock. And, you know, he obviously, as many people know, he's a very good friend of Mauro Ranallo's. And so we hang out with him and, you know, even had lunch. And he briefly mentioned the show. He also talked about like a future project that he was hoping to work on with Ken, but I don't think we can really talk about that.
Well, Ken Shamrock will be my guest this week on the MMA Report. Great segue.
Maybe did you ask him?
No, because I went to you after the interview and you told me this story, and I was like, oh, I wish I knew this before. I would have asked him.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll find out soon enough. But I think
Ken's going to be up in Toronto in a few weeks, so I'm sure. Somebody in our little Fight Network circle will have a chance to speak with
him. Well, excellent. But, you know, any type of reality show, I think anybody in wrestling or MMA in any type of reality show, I think is amusing, potential for a lot of hilarity.
Well, let's move on to a period of hilarity in wrestling. That was 1994. And you know, for those of you that maybe became fans during the Attitude Era, have stuck around over the last decade or so, maybe even just got into wrestling lately, Raw is the flagship show. But Raw was not always this gigantic, multiple six-figure production every single Monday night. It used to be a much more stripped-down version. And with all these cuts coming, maybe Raw is going to look closer to this a year from now. But
I don't know about that.
Well, they got to slash another $30 million next year. I mean, hey,
wouldn't that be awesome if all of a sudden took place with like studio cut-ins of matches that took place in Lowell, Massachusetts?
The siren comes back. Yeah. We've got green screens everywhere.
Got rid of the Titantron. It's that neon rainbow-colored entrance in the corner now.
Hey, wait, can you hear this fan I have in my room? I'm just paranoid that it's coming through.
I can't hear it.
Okay, we'll leave it then. And hopefully I'll remember to cut this out.
What?
All right. So we're going to review the two Raws going into SummerSlam of 1994. We were originally going to do 94, the SummerSlam event this week, but I pleaded to Wei. Can we please do something shorter because I just can't do it. But these shows were kind of fun to go back and watch. They were 45 minutes each, which were a huge positive.
Yes, 45 minutes each. And let's be honest, they really featured only four matches.
That's true. And though I did not need to see a two-hour Raw in this time period. There was one really solid match among these two shows, but man, they really pad these things out to make it 45 minutes.
Yeah. Well, but I think, you know, beyond the wrestling itself, I was curious to see a lot of the production, you know. I wanted to see how, like the Todd Pettengill things and then all this Leslie Nielsen stuff. Oh, my God. I don't remember any of this.
This was just weeks after the verdict had come down where Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation had been on trial for conspiracy to distribute steroids. And the verdict had come back not guilty. So this was just a mere weeks after that.
Interesting.
So this was a very, very important time for the company outside of the on-screen product. And so this was just coming out of the steroid trial.
Wait, do you think the 1-2-3 Kids push has anything to do with that?
The 1-2-3 Kid, certainly. Pushing non-giants was certainly something you could see throughout this particular show.
This government's really on my ass. Let's push the smallest guy we could possibly find.
Raymond Roy, we've got a spot for you.
Yeah.
So, as Wei mentioned, it was in Lowell, Massachusetts. This was actually a live edition of Raw. Of course, they did tape many weeks in advance sometimes, but this was a live week for them. And it started off with the program involving Tatanka and Lex Luger with a video about Tatanka's constant accusations that Lex Luger had secretly sold out to the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase. And Luger charges into DiBiase's dressing room and is trying to find him when Tatanka walks in and finds Luger in DiBiase's locker room, which leads to more conspiracy theories. Shoves Luger, and McMahon then gives the big sell. Maybe we'll find out if he sold out tonight on Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon in his element mm-hmm. on this particular edition of Raw.
I love it. I love it.
Oh, Vince McMahon just over the top. Yeah. I loved it. Randy Savage, though, was his broadcast partner. A very spirited, open way. Randy Savage was always a great, great talent. There is no way. There is no way on earth I could get through wrestling today if this man was doing color commentary regularly. I thought he was horrendous. Like, not even charming past 3 minutes. It was... At times, I don't even know if he knew what was happening. Like, he just worked in such lame humor, terrible catchphrases. I don't know how he lasted as long as he did on color commentary.
He's certainly not somebody you'd even really expect to kind of add drama or to push storylines. He was almost there as sort of like comic relief. And I mean, he didn't irritate me as much as, you know, he seemed to irritate you. But I mean, I just found him entertaining because it's not often, I guess, that we get to go back to this period and even hear Randy Savage do commentary. So I found him kind of endearing. But I could totally understand if he was the main guy on all these shows and all these angles, how he would be kind of detrimental.
So a very spirited open from Vince McMahon, who was just so excited. And this almost felt like when you go back and watch one of those WWE documentaries where they're looking back at the down period when WCW was really heating up, and they just show selective like screenshots and different stuff. And it's like, that was tonight's show, basically. Duke Drossy in action, Mabel accompanied by Oscar. And it was just what a lineup of characters they had. However, the show began with what I thought was the highlight.
Sorry to cut you off, but this was only months before Nitro debuted, right?
No, this was a full year before Nitro debuted.
Oh, okay.
Nitro was September of 95, so they had a full year to get prepared for the competition. The show kicked off with Owen Hart accompanied by Jim Neidhart against the 1-2-3 Kid, and Owen Hart would be challenging Bret Hart for the WWF title in 2 weeks at SummerSlam. And these two had a tremendous match. I can imagine at the time, this was probably thought of as even better than it was, because these matches were extremely rare in a Raw setting, or a WWF setting for that matter. Immediately, Owen hits there's a spinning heel kick hit by the 1-2-3 Kid to start, and Owen gets thrown into the post shoulder first. Great technical stuff back and forth. The crowd was really hot here. Early on, we got what a maneuver out of Vince to describe an enziguri, and they brought up the fact that Owen beat Bret at WrestleMania, setting up SummerSlam. So this had been the story that had been going back all the way until the Survivor Series from the past year, that they had really drawn out this feud with Bret and Owen. Hart hit this vertical suplex to the 1-2-3 Kid from the apron to the floor. Usually this is a spot where the guy reverses in midair, but nope, this time Sean Waltman took the vertical suplex right to the floor. Hart followed up with a pescado. Savage added to this great match, clear and present danger at its best. And I'm not talking about Harrison Ford, as he referenced the movie Clear and Present Danger, which I believe had just come out in theaters.
I don't know if I've ever, going back to any of these shows, I don't know if I've ever heard more dated references from any commentator than Randy Savage. It seemed like almost everything coming out of his mouth was something that you had to have been around in 1994 to understand. Like, I mean, I understand people referencing things even today, but like, it would be like JBL constantly referencing like Miley Cyrus or like things that if people watching 20 years from now would have to Wikipedia to completely understand.
Well, sometimes you have to do that with JBL. He'll bring up stuff that is so off the mark. It's not even contemporary.
But he'll bring up like old references. He'll bring up like, yes, like, you know, maybe references from 1994 in 2014. But this like Savage would just like it was almost like he was you know, reading the National Enquirer to pick all his references.
He just had a lineup of movies and songs to work into his commentary. That was his prep. So Hart is attacking the back of Waltman, hits an elbow drop off the turnbuckle. There's this desperation sunset flip from the 1-2-3 Kid that Hart kicks out of, a reverse neck breaker to Kid, and then misses a top rope knee drop. Owen is selling his knee, and then 1-2-3 Kid locks on a half crab, and Owen is tapping furiously, but unfortunately the tap was not
He wasn't really tapping. He was just like kind of motioning out of pain. It wasn't to
Well, yeah, it was out of pain, but nonetheless, like, furiously hitting the mat to sell this. And this leads to Jim Neidhart running in to attack the 1-2-3 Kid, and the bell is called. They beat down on the 1-2-3 Kid after the match. Owen applies the sharpshooter, and a sea of mullets ran in to break this up.
A lot of mullets on this show. A lot. And starting with the 1-2-3 Kids, I forget just exactly how over he was at this period. I mean, they really kind of gave him the ultimate underdog story, starting with that win over Razor. And then even they made mention here, a near win over the champion, Bret the Hitman Hart. And you know what? Like, it totally worked. You know, he so popular with this audience. He was an incredible high flyer, especially for his time. And matches like these were very good consistently.
Yeah, this was just a really, really good television match. And these two just worked very, very well together. Enjoyed this.
I didn't even mind the DQ because it kind of made sense leading into the cage match stipulation where they kind of, you know, they talked about how in a cage, Jim wouldn't be able to run in it and to save Owen and all that.
Yeah, that played in very well to the story. They went to Todd Pettengill with the SummerSlam report. I remember as a kid, I always loved these segments because I thought they were going to announce a new match for the pay-per-view. And this was SummerSlam taking place on a Monday night. Todd was wearing a red button-up shirt with this light yellow blazer. It looked hideous. It looked like Hulk Hogan had exploded on Todd's body. So then they throw to Razor Ramon and Walter Payton, the former football player who will be in Razor Ramon's corner when he takes on Diesel at SummerSlam. What a lesson here, Wei, in terms of what the WWF could use maybe with Brock Lesnar. Because we saw this on both shows, the exact same shot of Razor Ramon and Walter Payton, where Walter Payton just kept changing shirts. And I would imagine that they went to Walter Payton's house and they probably shot 8 of these for 8 weeks of TV leading up to SummerSlam and just had Walter change his shirt for each promo. And these were so generic.
That's right, Shawn Michaels. The way I look at it, the Razor can take care of Big Daddy Cool Diesel himself. But if you interfere, you're going to find out firsthand what the NFL is all about.
And the big line was Payton saying that Diesel will find out what the NFL is all about.
Oh, yeah. These are like, I mean, not more than 30 seconds each. And, you know, they serve the purpose of putting Walter Payton on every episode leading up into SummerSlam. But I just find it amusing that how, I mean, we do this, you know, you do this, John, on set, where sometimes you have to film multiple things in a day because, you know, either you or one of the other co-hosts will be away. And all you do is just change a shirt. You won't even change your pants. You'll just change your shirt to signify that it's a new day. And I just find it amusing that that makes sense because you're at least on set. But the idea that Razor Ramon is hanging out at Walter Payton's house
for weeks.
just to do these, and the only difference we see is oh obviously this is a different day because Walter Payton is wearing a new shirt. I find that hilarious that we think TV audiences are that dumb.
They're living together to prepare for Walter being in his corner at SummerSlam.
Yeah, they've even decided to stand in the exact same formation in the exact same spot in front of the same object this whole time.
Now today we have the WWE app that is one of the big toys they really like to push on you. Well, back here in 1994, it was the hotline where they have set up an opinion line where you can pay money to vote if you believe Lex Luger has sold out to Ted DiBiase or not.
Well, to be fair, people do that now, like on like American Idol, but at least that ends up in some type of result. This results in nothing.
this what could be the best case scenario? There's a landslide vote and Lex Luger has to go with the results. I mean, I couldn't fathom any desire to spend money to log on and vote for this opinion line.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
But hey, whatever. This was the lean times way. You had to maximize those dollars out of your hardcore.
I wonder how well they did with something like this, you know, because
I would love to know. I would love to interview somebody who was behind working on the superstar line, either in WWF or WCW. That would be fun. Because I heard that some of those guys on the hotline made a good amount of money because they got a back end of whatever calls they could generate for their hotline reports. Like Jim Ross had one. There were all these guys, Gene Okerlund.
Yeah.
And there was a time when Gene would always go out there, and no matter how ridiculous the story was and somewhat misleading at times, he'd always have some hook to send you to the hotline to get the exclusive news on. Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be great if we could charge people now to tweet? Like if you tweet at a celebrity, you'll have to pay. Huh?
Sure. You should try. Instead of having the locked symbol, you could have a dollar sign that this person will only accept tweets for 99 cents per tweet.
Yeah, the person doesn't have to respond to you or anything. Just to kind of give your opinion about that person to that person, you'll have to pay.
I would love it if...
It would limit a lot of dumb tweets.
Oh, could you imagine if you could only... If you could only tweet people you don't follow, it would cost you 50 cents. Do you know how much less hatred would be out there in the world if you had to pay to tweet someone who does not follow you? Just a random person you want to look up on Twitter.
Life
would be better.
Yeah, I suppose. But
it's only free. It's only free if they follow you.
Yeah, okay. That's
interesting. See what I mean? I could tweet you, but if I wanted to go find X band member of some whoever, and I want to say, hey, your show sucked last night, well, that's going to cost me 50 cents.
Yeah, I imagine there'd probably be a lot less tweeting going on in general at that point.
That would be great. I'd be fine with that. Then, oh boy, then we took a dive. Abe Knuckleball Schwartz, Steve Lombardi, under one of his many aliases, he is in the crowd. He is on strike. This was during the Major League Baseball strike of 1994, which killed the Montreal Expos year. And they show a promo that they couldn't even run live. This was from earlier in the night.
You know something? I have this whole baseball strike thing figured out. You cannot blame the owners. You fans allow the owners to take your hard-earned municipal taxpayers' money to build elaborate stadiums all over the world. They're just being good businessmen. You certainly can't blame us ball players. You say, hey, can I have an autograph? But I insist on paying you hundreds of dollars. We're just being good businessmen. If you insist on casting blame on anyone, cast blame on your own ignorant, stinking selves, the fans.
Where he cuts this god-awful promo about how the fans shouldn't be blaming the owners. The fans allowed the owners to take their taxpayer dollars. And the owners are being good businessmen, and it's the fans' ignorance, which is to blame for a completely different area of entertainment being on strike. And the crowd boos this.
Yeah.
This sucks.
He claims to be a baseball player, a professional baseball player. And you could tell because he's painted a baseball on his face. That's how you could tell. I just remember, I mean, I was a big baseball fan at this time, actually, because
as was I.
Yeah, this was right after the Jays had won their season, and all I remember from this strike is that they really kind of screwed Montreal, because Montreal was just having an incredible year, and the strike happened and they never recovered.
No, it was That's what's always brought up with that strike of 94 is what could have happened with the Expos, and the Canadian teams could have potentially won 3 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
But this character, unfortunately, would not make it past year one. We also had the Ring Card Girls at this time on Raw, with holding up signs such as Raw to the Bone.
I don't remember this at all. I knew I saw something like that, but I thought it was somebody – it was part of somebody's entrance. I completely forgot that there were
– No, these were the Raw Girls.
Like in a
– The future Ariane Celeste of the world.
That's right. But just – I suppose it's a good enough idea, but there are no rounds in wrestling. So just to have cards for – you know, holding up random slogans. That's what they did.
To be fair, Way, I mean, have you ever watched an MMA fight and been confused? Oh, shit. What round is this? What round? Oh, thank God.
No, okay.
It's two. I think they're there for another reason than just for statistical nerds out there to keep track of juncture of the fight
you're right, that's very true, but it's part of the formality. I mean, Bruce Buffer telling me who the people are, it's not like he's fulfilling that much of a need that the program or the graphics can't fulfill. It's at least, you know, you could fake you can explain the reason to somebody who's never seen before. Oh, why are there these girls here? Oh, they're there to show the cards. Like with this, I don't know. I'm sure it was a fine idea at the time.
There was a Ico Pro spot featuring Razor Ramon working out vigorously while chewing a toothpick in a gym. Then we had Duke the Dumpster Drosy against Nick Barberry. Barberry actually did get some offense here before Irish Whip was reversed. He got clotheslined by Duke, who then yelled out, "It's time to take out the trash," and hits a running elbow drop off the ropes for a win in a minute 25, and then grabs his trash can and trash lid and plays it together as if it is a musical instrument.
Yeah, like the cymbals.
Well, this was symbolic of a shitty time in WWF history.
Yeah, so you know what a pattern you'll notice on these shows is that they'll start off with a match between two people you recognize, and they'll end off with a match between two people you recognize. But in between that sandwich is shit,
garbage.
Yeah, literally. Duke the Dumpster Drosy and Barbary, Abe Knuckleball Schwartz. Is just the most disgusting sandwich on the inside, but it looks amazing from the outside.
It would not be one of the W.H. Park's sandwich recommendations for you Japanese audio wrestling listeners out there. Then we got a Leslie Nielsen segment. He has been hired to solve the case of how there are two Undertakers. Features Ray Rougeau.
I was trying to figure out the reference here. And then I, okay, of course. Naked Gun.
Yes. Ray Rougeau was here. They were by a pool. There were some women fawning over Randy Savage, who insinuated that they wanted to fuck him, and Savage said that this is family programming. Leslie is then reading some tabloid magazine about the Undertaker, while there is a little kid reading the Wall Street Journal who insults Nielsen. And it leads to a doppelganger of Leslie Nielsen appearing and having the fake Leslie Nielsen arrested. Did I get this right?
Yeah, pretty much. They put a lot of money into this, it looked like.
Oh, and what a return on investment, too.
I guess so.
The case would be solved at SummerSlam, we were promised.
Like, I know it was a popular series. I know there are like three movies that came out of it. But was it that big? To warrant all this? Did they think that it would make that big of a difference to the SummerSlam?
You know what? I almost think that when they were hashing out these vignettes, it was like someone came up with the classic line that these vignettes culminated in, which we will get to at SummerSlam, and then they just tried to work backwards from a shitty joke backwards.
Okay, yeah. It just looked like certainly there was a lot of money put into this. at a time where I wonder if they, I don't know, if they should have.
When business was down and we need to really hit a home run. Leslie Nielsen.
Mm-hmm.
He will be our celebrity at SummerSlam. Ted DiBiase joins the commentary team, and Vince is plugging the SummerSlam opinion line to go cast your vote as we got to bear witness to Quang, the future Savio Vega, under a mask, accompanied by Harvey Whippleman, taking on Tony Roy. And this featured Quang with stomps. He blew this red mist into the air, hit a spinning heel kick, and pinned Tony Roy in 45 seconds that Savage noted was a big victory for Quang.
What was the idea here? He's playing an Asian guy?
Yeah. Felt like a martial arts influence and kind of a response to kind of this amalgamation of Kabuki, Muda. That's what it felt like.
And why did they get a Puerto Rican to do that?
Because I guess they assumed martial arts in Puerto Rico. I have no clue. Maybe they signed this guy and
he's billed.
They wanted a martial arts practitioner from the Orient. And
he's actually billed from the Orient.
Well, come on. You need
that's where I'm,
large picture area.
That's where I'm from.
The Orient.
That's what I tell people. Where were you originally? Where did you immigrate from? The Orient. It's what it says on my passport.
Just in big, like the lettering of choice. Yeah, the you can only spell Oriental with one font.
Chinese restaurant font, yes. Exactly.
King's Court segment was next, where Jerry Lawler had Ted DiBiase in the ring. Says that Paul Bearer has shown no proof that he has the Undertaker. And Paul Bearer comes out to the ring. He says that what we have seen of Ted DiBiase with the Undertaker is all well and good, but there is no Paul Bearer unless you have the Undertaker. Bearer then says his Undertaker will destroy Ted DiBiase's. The Undertaker, the fake Undertaker, comes out. God, this makes no sense. Just trying to explain this. DiBiase's version comes out to face Paul Bearer. Savage notes that this Undertaker looks to be approximately 100 feet tall. Paul Bearer says that he sees the evil in the Undertaker's eyes, and those eyes will be closed forever at SummerSlam, and his Undertaker will destroy him. The saving grace of this being Paul Bearer's delivery, which was just so outlandish that I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I see the evil in your eyes. But you know, at SummerSlam, those eyes will be closed forever. Oh. Because my Undertaker, the true Undertaker, will destroy you. Oh, yeah.
That's something I took away from this, too, because I think in the past, Paul Bearer was just kind of there for me. He was just the guy who did his character. But I think, you know, after his passing, and then there's a lot of reflection about him as a person actually performing this as sort of an actor. I think, at least for me, I'm able to appreciate the performance a lot more looking back now.
There was nobody, I think, that could have done this character this well. I mean, he was tremendous. Oh, the voice.
It seemed like his own creation, 100%.
It was great. The fake Undertaker grabs Paul Bearer by the throat, and the lights start flickering, which I believe would have just been a problem with the Lowell Memorial Auditorium that they were in. Not the most up-to-date venue this appeared to be. But the lights are flickering. They go out, and then Paul Bearer is on the floor as the lights come on, yelling that his Undertaker is here, and he has escaped from the clutches of the Underfaker.
Yes, that's right.
Big showdown way. Main event of WrestleMania, of SummerSlam.
And if you,
Undertaker versus Undertaker.
If you notice, they had purple lighting.
Yes, to signify. That would be the color scheme change for the Undertaker when he would return. He would go from gray to purple. Yeah.
When you think about it, this is, the storyline is completely ridiculous. We have a fake version of a guy, and But you know what? As a kid, I totally bought into this because I thought they did a great job making this fake Undertaker look like fake Undertaker. And was it Brian Lee, his name?
Yes, Brian Lee, the future DOA member.
Yeah, I thought he did a very good job, you know, mimicking the mannerisms and, you know, costume-wise, they kept him very mysterious. They made him look very good. And, you know, you have to say something about, you know, their ability to kind of not make the big reveal, not even a little stare down until the day of the match.
I really wish that, you know, if we could have been around in 1994 just to hear like the, I guess you couldn't really, you could call it maybe the very early infancy of the internet fans out there, but contrasting the Undertaker versus the Undertaker to like the Bret Hart Owen program. Like, you couldn't have two more extremes that you were promoting as your double main event for SummerSlam. Like, there had to be an audience that was just absolutely outraged at the fact that the Undertaker match would go on last at SummerSlam and was given equal billing. Like, this, to me, were the two extremes of the WWF.
Could you imagine, like, a fake Bret Hart versus a Bret Hart versus Bret Hart match?
Yeah, they came out that night after Survivor Series, the midget.
Yes.
Maybe one day they'll go back to this concept. Who could you do this with? A character against his fake self?
I mean, it would have to be somebody masked. Sin Cara, they did that recently.
Oh, they did do that. You're right.
It would have to, but as far as like an unmasked person, I think it would be difficult. And I don't exactly know how all that Sin Cara versus Sin Cara thing worked out.
Willow versus Jeff Hardy.
Yeah, sure. You could do that.
Mabel was out next with Oscar, doing his entrance with Oscar rapping, and he was going to be taking – Mabel even got pyro. They clearly were starting to separate him from Mo and turn him into more of a singles performer. He had a singles match with Jeff Jarrett at SummerSlam, so giving the big push here to Nelson Frazier.
He was just known as Om.
Om. And his opponent tonight was – Raymond Roy.
What, was there two Roys?
There were two Roys in back-to-back squash matches. I don't know if there was any relation. I would not imagine these were real names.
Maybe this
was probably some inside joke, I would guess.
Somebody's a big Patrick Roy fan.
Patrick Roy. Yeah.
I know it's not pronounced Roy.
Yeah, in Canada, you would think it was growing up if you were a hockey night in Canada.
There's always the joke that when the Nordiques moved to Colorado, that everybody would start pronouncing his name Pat Roy.
Pat Roy.
Call him Pat Roy.
Mabel snaps the neck of Raymond Roy with a forward roll, like the spot that Mr. Perfect used to do. Hits a big boot to Roy, a back elbow, where Mabel himself falls down from hitting this back elbow. The highlight of the commentary.
I know what you're going to say. I know exactly what you're going to say.
And off the rope, and oh, with an elbow right in the mush.
What, does Mabel follow through or what?
He certainly does. Oops, there it is.
Oops. There it is.
Oh, man. Awesome. I love it.
Oops. There it is.
That song was so big at the time. And you know, even as a kid, that by the time Vince McMahon butchers it on pro wrestling commentary,
the song's dead.
Yeah. It's not cool anymore. Oops. There it is.
I rewound this to make sure I heard this properly. And believe me, that's no easy task on the WWE Network, going back anything more than 10 seconds. There's a splash in the corner. Savage somehow, during the finish, is talking about how he thinks he's contracted malaria because it's so hot inside of this building. And Mabel hits an elbow off the second turnbuckle and pins Raymond Roy.
Almost in the same fashion, elbow and then pinning Roy. Interesting. So maybe they got the same script, Duke Drosy and Mabel.
Yeah, maybe it was just this was like a redo of the prior match. Mm-hmm. It's So there you go. Not much to talk about. Then they plugged this show, Sunday Night Slam, happening this Sunday on the USA Network, which would feature Lex Luger against Crush, Diesel against Typhoon, and a Bret Hart interview. And I was thinking, damn, like to get ready for SummerSlam, I wish we could have found this show. This looked like the big go-home show for SummerSlam. Little did we know what Raw the very next night after Sunday Night Slam would reflect, as they basically presented the same show on back-to-back nights.
Oh, okay, that's why.
Yeah.
Like, that's why there are all those matches from that arena, but were they the same matches?
Yes.
Wow, really? Okay. Interesting. That's very lazy.
Our main event, Jeff Jarrett and Scotty Taylor. The future, Scotty Too Hotty, who you could argue would become maybe one of the biggest stars out of this whole show.
No. I would say.
Scott Taylor?
Okay.
The Attitude Era?
I would say X-Pac, bigger than him. Certainly in terms of the way we remember wrestlers, Owen, for sure. And
outside of that, he was... I don't know.
You can argue Mabel because he won a King of the Ring. But as far as the in-ring performance...
Scott Taylor was a really over mid-card act during the height of the company in 2000.
But if you're talking about bigger stars, I don't even know. I think Jarrett would be above him.
Perhaps. I think it depends. I mean, there were more people. I mean, when Jeff Jarrett was a headliner in WCW in 2000, there were way more people watching Scott Taylor matches on Raw than were watching main events of Nitro at that time.
Maybe. We'll do a poll. But we'll do an opinion hotline.
All right. Jeff Jarrett versus Scott Taylor. The real main event.
$1.99.
Our opinion poll.
$1.99 to vote.
Yeah. Get your parents' permission. There was a sunset flip by Taylor for a two count. Jarrett got the advantage, blocked an O'Connor roll. There was a small package by Taylor for a two count, got in a bit of offense. Taylor then missed a reverse cross as Jarrett ducked, and then Jarrett attacks his knee, applies the figure four, and gets the submission in a minute 54. And then Mabel and Oscar come out, with Oscar rapping about Jeff Jarrett, promoting their SummerSlam match, as Jarrett calls him a chicken for not coming into the ring, as the officials separate them to go to break, with Jeff Jarrett doing the chicken symbolic dance.
The chicken dance.
And it finishes, they come back from break, where Vince McMahon and Savage are talking about all the fun they have had over the last hour. They plug Sunday Night Slam, and this would also...
It's like how every Raw should end.
Like a final thought.
Yeah, in the overrun. The overrun is just the final... Yeah, coming back from commercial, where the announcers talk about how much fun that was.
Now, the one drawback to not seeing... the full Sunday Night Slam, they plugged the fact that the final 30 minutes of Sunday Night Slam would be a call-in segment where you could voice your opinion, which I would very, very much like to have gone back and heard these fans in 1994. And Vince is doing this whole sell for the show and then finally just looks at Savage and says, "Say something." Savage is just sitting there with nothing to add. I think he had run out of his list of topical comments.
All that in addition to you calling in live, it's going to be 30 minutes of it after the SummerSlam slap, the Sunday Night Slam. Randy Savage, you can't even hear yourself think. Say something, Randy.
Wham, bam, Sunday Night Slam's going to be cool.
So long, everybody.
And just gave some random promo to end the show off with. What an awkward end to this Raw.
I loved how... It felt like Vince was certainly in broadcast mode, and yeah, Savage was playing his character, but he didn't seem at all to kind of, I guess you could say he didn't seem to take it seriously, but that's not even what I really mean. It just means like it didn't feel like he was.
Let's be honest, he was not excited for Sunday Night Slam, nor did he seem too stoked for this year's SummerSlam.
Okay, yeah, it was that, but I just also love how he... There's like an air of him not really giving a shit about how he came across on TV, and he would just kind of randomly do anything to kind of, you know, be outrageous.
Well, this was also the time. I mean, remember, it would be later that year, in November when he would leave the company and then go over to WCW before the end of the year. And one of the big things was the fact that Vince only saw him as a color commentator at this point in his career. He thought he was done in the ring, and Savage disagreed.
Yeah.
And Savage had many more years of drawing very well in WCW, despite his age. I mean, that was the big lesson of WCW, was that even these performers that might have been past their physical peak were not past their drawing peak. And this was, I mean, you watch this show, Savage was maybe the biggest star on any of these two shows we watched.
Absolutely.
And a completely non-important role he was in. Like, this was a waste of Randy Savage for what he was probably making at the time as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes us to the following Monday, August 22nd of 1994, where we start things off with Vince and Randy Savage in the WWF studios, both in red bow ties. Do you notice that?
Vaguely. I did notice Savage wearing a Monday Night Raw suit. He had like one of his frizzy tasseled jackets made with the Monday Night Raw logo and the colors. And as the cameras are cutting into the show, they have like a big wide shot with like a jib zooming into these two on top of a riser. Savage is like doing his hand gestures, rocking on his chair, and he almost falls down.
Oh, really?
I missed this. Yeah, he came back.
These are the moments you need to go back and watch.
Yeah. He comes back and he's, almost fell down. He actually makes mention of it.
Savage also was able to work in a shot towards Deion Sanders, saying he thinks he recently sold out. And then when he's asked about Lex Luger selling out, he says, if the DNA matches, there is a 99% chance he sold out. This would lead to an actual payoff at the end of the show when Randy Savage would get the DNA results of whether Lex Luger's blood had been contaminated by Ted DiBiase's money.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you had a time machine and there's like if somebody were to travel from the year 1994 to our present, and let me try it again. If somebody were to travel from 1993 to our time, and they wanted to know what happened in 1994 because they completely missed it, you just have to watch these two shows, and you can get most of what you missed. You got the Deion Sanders, whatever, DNA shit. He mentions David Letterman and Madonna at one point. Just all this.
The baseball strike.
Yeah, Neil's
tag team.
You
were all up on pop culture here.
That's right.
So I took this to mean that this was the WWF's way of saying after the steroid trial that there's blood testing going on in the World Wrestling Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Lex Luger and Crush kicked things off with the commentary team of Jim Ross and Gorilla Monsoon. What a contrast hearing Jim Ross as compared to Vince McMahon in 1994. I really enjoyed this commentary. Crowd was very hot at the start of the match. There's a mid-ring crossbody for a two count by Luger, and then back to a headlock. Luger blocked a pile driver to hit a back body drop, and then a shoulder block sends Crush to the floor. Crush then hits a backbreaker, works over the lower back of Luger, including a camel clutch, a bear hug. Then Ted DiBiase shows up at ringside as they go to break. They come back. Both are down from shoulder blocks as Ted is rooting on Luger. Luger starts to fight back with clotheslines. He fires up, hits a power slam, a DDT. Crush then responds with a tilt-a-whirl, and Ted DiBiase gets onto the apron, and he's offering money to Crush to leave Luger alone. And Crush refuses the money, turns around, and Luger hits his running forearm and pins Crush after the distraction finish from Ted DiBiase, leading people to think that the two are in cahoots with one another. But crowd was into the match. Can't say this was any kind of a Matt classic, but Lex Luger gets the win.
It's not surprising that the crowd would be into any of these matches, because think about what what else they've been used to seeing, you know? Duke Drosy versus Rob Roy. And then all of a sudden you get...
Raymond Roy, come on. Don't do him a service.
Sorry. And then all of a sudden you get two guys that you've actually heard of facing each other. So no wonder they'd react to something even as small as, you know, somebody getting tossed out of the ring in a match like this.
They go back to Vincent Savage in the studios debating if Luger has sold out. Savage believes he has. Says DiBiase is not a manager. He's an owner. And he gets a notice. And he opens up the envelope and says the DNA matches and proclaims that Lex Luger will sell out in 1 week at SummerSlam. I was begging to see what this notification said.
Yeah, I think this was
a really bad
like a Maury Povich type of thing, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. And then he proceeds to explain to order how to order pay-per-views to the audience. Randy Savage.
Yeah.
Randy Savage says, "Just go to your last bill, look in the corner, and call the number to order."
God, it sounded so complex back then.
I can't imagine going through all that trouble these days to order a show. I mean, I'm just, you know, we're used to just going to the screen and hitting a button. Now you don't even have to do that.
Well, Vince said, if you have interactive services, simply, quote, mash the button.
That's right.
Mash it.
Smash it. Just hit a bunch of random buttons.
One of them will come up with buy.
Although I suppose like now with the network, things are just as complicated, if not more.
Did you have any problems watching this on the network? Because I had lots.
Depending on my computer. I have a slower computer that it kept buffering. It's weird because on that computer, like, you know, Netflix works well, YouTube works well, but the network – one of the issues with the network is that you can't select a lower bit rate to stream from.
That's true.
And so it's constantly – even for a show like this, constantly, you know, trying to download at – the highest quality possible, and I think that's why it takes so long.
I watched this on Saturday, and that day I had watched probably 4 hours of the G1 on Ustream without one issue. I watched this, and it crashed no less than 6 times watching these two Raws.
Like freezing or like just stopping?
No, completely crashed, and I had to reload the page where I got the crashed face on my – on my player. Not to mention watching these Raws, like we watched the, or at least I did. I watched these in like one sitting. But I mean, if I took a break and came back and I was at the Diesel Typhoon match, I mean, there's no way. You just have to pretty much guess where you're going on this bloody player. It drives me nuts.
Yeah, it's weird for me because at some points, sometimes it resumes, but other times you're right. I have to start completely over. I have to see the.
Like, there's no way to toggle, like, through, like, even to note what time you were at.
No, yeah,
like,
there
you
is.
You can't do that.
What do you mean? Why isn't there? You can see the timer.
Yeah, if you're scrolling to get to a place, you just have to, like, blindly click and hope you come within that ballpark of where you were before. Whereas, like, a YouTube, for instance, you can just simply press down on your mouse and just scroll to, hey, I was at 2350. And there's no problem there.
Yeah. That's true. You got to just...
You can't highlight and the time comes up so you can pick where you were last. It just drives me insane.
You just have to click everywhere. You have to click until you get close to the spot.
There's times I can do... I'll do that. And if I click too many times at a time, it stops working.
Yeah.
And I've got to reload the page to continue navigating.
Yeah, right.
I feel like I'm the only person who goes through this because I never hear any complaints about this, but it's the worst player that I have encountered.
No, I think a lot of people go through it, but I think everybody just kind of puts up with it because it's, you know.
People get very defensive when you critique the technology. Whenever I say anything about the network, I get bombarded by people. Dude, it's your service. There's nothing wrong with the network. It's like, Let's be a little less defensive.
Yeah.
As I said, I just watched 4 hours of the G1 on the same computer without any buffering issues, without any crashes. And then this, six times for 90 minutes of content.
No, I have the same problems too. But I think, you know, like, yeah, you're right. Like I watch Netflix on it. You know, I watch a lot of things on the same computer, but it's only, and I think like I said, the biggest problem is probably just the inability to select your, you know, the bit rate. If there's a way to do that, please let me know.
These are the reasons why I am embracing the actual traditional channel version of the WWE Network. I will take a stripped down version of the network on TV as opposed to this version myself.
Well, I don't know if we'll be able to watch, you know, these shows, like shows as obscure as, you know, the August 15th and 22nd, 1994 editions of Raw on that version.
We'll find out. We shall see. It launches in a week. So after that, they recap the Brett-Owen feud, showcasing Owen attacking Brett at the Royal Rumble, the WrestleMania win, King of the Ring, where Jim Neidhart joined Owen, even featuring Bruce Hart on an edition of the King's Court. I wanted a sound up here, but not just in passing. We saw Bruce.
I think it's amazing how they show this recap, and they essentially just showcase three major events that took place within the span of 8 months. I mean, I found that to be quite incredible.
And it went even longer. I mean, the first tease of the turn was at the Survivor Series when the Hart family, everyone survived except Owen, and he came back and pulled Brett off the corner. I mean, and that would it extended past SummerSlam. I mean, you go to the next year's Survivor Series, that was the infamous I Quit match where Owen got Helen to throw the towel in. I mean, they got amazing mileage out of that feud.
Yeah, that's right. These days it'd probably be 2 months max.
Yeah. Owen and Neidhart, they show a promo from Superstars with Vince in this dimly lit arena with the cage set up and just pretty much cutting a promo, setting up SummerSlam. And then Bret Hart comes out as part of Sunday Night Slam, which they put the Sunday Night Slam like logo on the screen, but then he came out to the Superstars set with Ray Rougeau. And Ray Rougeau sets this up by saying, Owen has said he will rattle your cage at SummerSlam. This would be Ray Rougeau's only bit of dialogue for the next 5 minutes, where Brett would just ignore Ray and cut his promo, talking about how there wasn't as much on the line, such as the title, in their last match, and this one will be a whole different ball of wax. Says his whole family is coming to Chicago at the SummerSlam. He calls the cage match the most dangerous match. Careers can end. Says he might have taken it a bit easy on Owen at WrestleMania, but he won't this time. He says, in the past, I have called Jim Neidhart fat, but now I want to point out he's also stupid. And this crowd gasped at this insult. And then finally adds in that he remembers seeing Owen as a baby crying in his crib. And Brett would crawl up to the crib and do a chin-up over the bars, and says it's going to be the exact same at the SummerSlam, where Owen will be crying himself a river behind those bars.
Oh.
I thought a very good promo by Bret Hart standards, where he always gets knocked for his promos at this time. I thought this one was very good.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I know a lot of people, you know, it's always one of the criticisms, and even from Bret himself, that he's not a very good promo. But I, as a child watching this, I always just thought he totally fit the role. You know, he spoke clearly, spoke confidently, spoke like a leader, you know what I mean?
Like the top athlete in the company,
yeah.
The best wrestler in the company would speak.
Exactly. And, you know, just even from a personal nostalgic point of view, it was fun for me to see something like this because, you know, Brett's title reigns really, they weren't as frequent as many people's reigns today, obviously. So anytime to get to see him in this image of him wearing that leather jacket with that winged eagle title, to me, this is sort of like the definitive period of Brett's career.
They followed that with a Leslie Nielsen segment where he was just in front of a bunch of green screens. showcasing him going around the world on a WWF budget in 94. The lights go out, and then Leslie Nielsen is at his office logging his case details when he drops his pen, and then there is a knock at the door. He tells the person to come in, and it's Domino's Pizza, which was the title sponsor at SummerSlam, with a delivery man delivering his pizza, but it's The Undertaker. And Leslie Nielsen is too distracted looking for his pen, telling the guy to leave it on the desk. And Taker drops off the Domino's pizza and leaves. And Leslie Nielsen completely misses The Undertaker, whose new job is now delivering pizzas.
Detectives log, one of the most mysterious superstars of the WWF is missing, and they've come to me as the one man with the ability and the know-how to find him. The one man, they say, who can track down anything. To locate missing persons requires organization, discipline, intelligence. But the most important thing of all is, Domino's, send it right up. The most important thing of all is never going to work on an empty stomach. Now, where'd I put my pen? Oh, boy.
Oop. Yes?
Pizza.
Put it on the desk.
Suddenly got colder out here.
What the fuck was going on?
Yeah, this should have been the promotion for the streak at WrestleMania.
My God.
The Undertaker delivering pizzas and saying in his Undertaker voice, pizza. They actually had him do that on this, and I couldn't believe it. At the time, sure, you can understand, but somebody as protective of as they are to have him be your Damian Sandow or whatever, Adam Rose, in a skit like this is incredible. The Undertaker delivered pizza.
I fully believe that the reason that Undertaker character stayed so strong is because that guy probably reached a point where he absolutely turned down stupid ideas, because you knew many, given that kind of a character must have been pitched to him. And I give him more credit than I would the WWF of keeping that character as strong as he has over all of these years, when so many horrible ideas must have come his way along the years.
We could maybe – at least we can assume that this was maybe the fake Undertaker that was doing this, because he's the sellout, right?
Perhaps. Maybe he sold out to Domino's though.
Yeah, sure. He fights for pizza now.
Oh. Then they go back to Vince and Savage, who plug a WWF Superstars versus Chicago Media All-Stars softball game involving Jerry Lawler and Mancow, where Savage will be the umpire. Why this had to be broadcast nationally on the USA Network, I don't know why, but this was quite the softball game they were promoting. Mm. And then we go to the main event, Diesel against Typhoon in a non-title match.
Typhoon weighed in at 384 pounds.
Yes. This was also post-Shockmaster run for Typhoon, who had returned to the WWF for about 2 months.
Oh, wow.
This would be his final run with the company. Shawn Michaels is in the corner of Diesel, and a shoulder block takes down Diesel. He follows with a scoop slam. Michaels is distracting Typhoon as Diesel attacks him from behind, hits a flying shoulder block. Diesel then misses a big boot in the corner. Typhoon then misses a leg drop. There is a splash to Diesel in the corner, but then he runs into the big boot, gets taken down with a clothesline, and Diesel wins via clothesline at 4 minutes and 13 seconds. And the idea here, very much similar to Owen and Jim Neidhart, was that Diesel has this backup plan in Shawn Michaels, who can always distract the opponent, and at SummerSlam, Walter Payton will be there to combat him, which I get that was the story, but it's kind of perplexing that arguably your number two performer in the entire industry is not going to be on your big pay-per-view because he's going to be in someone's corner instead.
Yeah, and to suggest that, I mean, I'm not a football fan, but I suppose to suggest that Walter Payton is enough to combat Shawn Michaels. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe he was a big deal. Maybe he had some real life fighting back.
Well, in Chicago, I mean, he was a big, you know, sports figure there for that local market in Chicago, and not like an obscure NFL player either.
To me, though, it sounds similar to having like Wayne Gretzky as the enforcer against Shawn Michaels.
Perhaps. Maybe Chris Chelios wasn't available.
Yeah, maybe.
For Chicago.
I guess that's sure. Football player would certainly makes a bit more sense.
So Diesel gets the win. Then we got week two, or at least the second straight, Razor Ramon Walter Payton promo, where, as we said, changed his shirt. Payton says he has seen Michaels cheap shots. It won't happen at SummerSlam. And Razor only has to worry about the Diesel. And both throw toothpicks at the camera.
Oh, my.
The Diesel.
Yeah. There we go.
McMahon and Savage then discussed Taker's exit at the Royal Rumble, where he was defeated by Yokozuna in the casket match, where Savage explains, without any joking manner, that it took Yokozuna and 455 other wrestlers to get rid of him, and says how it gave him the willies, McMahon. They throw back to the King's Court segment from last week. Savage comes back, says he has darkophobia, noting when the lights went out in the arena during the King's Court segment. And then Savage picks The Undertaker to win at SummerSlam. Ha ha. We get another Leslie Nielsen segment, just the same one where they were by the pool. And then it finishes with Vincent Savage announcing that there will be no Monday Night Raw for the next 2 weeks due to the U.S. Open. Savage says, "That is horrible," and ends it off. The final line to sell you on SummerSlam is Randy Savage saying, "That tennis is just a racket anyway," and Vince cackles to go off the air. What a contrast.
Yeah, certainly not the type of closing to a Raw that we see today.
No. No big promo, just we're preempted.
Yeah, that's, you could tell that he was kind of upset about that too, you know? Like he wasn't happy that they were
preempted. Yeah, they had Savage play bad guy though. Vince wasn't going to bury the network, yeah. But they allowed Savage to get the line in.
Well, it's the U.S. Open. Like he was clearly trying to say, what a lame excuse. We're not going to be on for 2 weeks because of tennis.
Meanwhile, we're busy trying to sell our Undertaker versus Undertaker match, The height of our programming here on the USA schedule.
Really bad timing for them to.
Yeah, I mean, that U.S. Open, I mean, they would get preempted for that. And the Westminster Dog Show, like right into the, even in 2000, they were still getting preempted. Mm-hmm. Like when the show was at a huge peak. It wasn't until they eventually came back in 2005 where they were able to finally get away from those preemptions, which always were annoying for U.S. viewers. I mean, in Canada, it really didn't matter.
Why did the dog shows always take place on a Monday?
When else would you have a dog show? Monday night. That's when Westminster wants to acknowledge the best in dogs.
All right.
Well, before we get on out of here, we have a whopping two pieces of feedback. We start off with Martin from London. This was a fun trip down memory lane, and after seeing 3-hour Raws today, the shows from the mid-90s feel like such a breeze being done in under an hour, although this was a different time when WCW wasn't quite pushing them like they would a year later. The clear highlight of the first show was the 1-2-3 Kid and Owen Hart. This was the match that their King of the Ring semifinal match should have been, and was a really good follow-up to Waltman's fantastic title match with Bret Hart the previous month. Ted DiBiase was the focus of two key storylines heading into SummerSlam with his fake Undertaker and the situation with Lex Luger and Tatanka. The shows gave alternating priorities to each storyline, with the debate with Paul Bearer being a key point of the first show. Second show was oddly structured as it came the day after a Sunday Night Slam special, which was also on the USA Network, and the meat of the show came from that special. I guess with the 2-week preemption and when SummerSlam was, they were kind of painted into a corner. Luger and Crush was a fine match, Bret Hart cut a good promo to hype the pay-per-view, and the Leslie Nielsen promos were corny but funny. Randy Savage was pretty crazy as Vince's commentary partner, but it kind of worked in an odd way. 6 Undertakers delivering Domino's pizzas out of 10.
Finally, Jeremy from Texas. Watching some of these old Raws, it's hard to believe that this was 20 years ago. But then again, watching the show and how it was structured with all the squash matches, it certainly showed its age, along with many of the performers on the show sadly no longer being with us. A good match to start the first show with Owen Hart and a very young Sean Waltman. Interesting to see that 20 years ago, you actually had to verbally give up in a submission hold because Owen was clearly tapping when he was in the half crab. Is there a moment when tapping out became mainstream in pro wrestling? Yeah, we've answered this before. Wasn't it like Ken Shamrock? Wasn't he the first? I mean,
it was beginning over in Japan as well. But for a WWF audience, yeah, it was Ken Shamrock that kind of introduced the tapping as the alternate way to end a match in the WWF world.
Not a big fan of the structure of the second show. It felt like an episode of Primetime Wrestling with them highlighting storylines in the studio and throwing to tape segments in the arena. I enjoyed hearing JR and Gorilla, but it must have been easier being an announcer at this time, because if you worked with Vince, he could be shouting in your ear producing you at the time. Macho Man seemed to mess with Vince a lot because he didn't want to be stuck behind the microphone. 4 Raw preemptions because of the US Open out of 10.
All right. Well, thanks. Thank you to both of you for your pieces of feedback. Next week, as we mentioned, SummerSlam 1994 will be reviewed, featuring The Undertaker versus The Undertaker, Bret and Owen in a cage, and will Lex Luger's DNA reveal that he sold out to Ted DiBiase? I'm at the edge of my seat, Wade.
Yeah.
So that's coming up next week, and also later this week, on Thursday, as I mentioned, I'll be joined by Ken Shamrock on the MMA Report. We'll have Nate Milton up with Review and Impact with myself and Mr. Ting. The G1 is coming to a conclusion with Friday, the Yokohama show. I'm going to be chatting with W.H. Park and possibly Chris Charlton as well to preview the finals, which are happening on Sunday. And we'll have a show up on Sunday recapping the finals with W.H. Park and myself. And then, of course, Sunday night on The Law, we'll be joined by Batista and Paul Heyman. What a big show on Sunday night at 11 Eastern with myself and Jason Agnew. So we are going to wrap things up here. Mr. Ting, is there any way to possibly end this show?
Well, I figure since we've talked so much about the man, Walter Payton, a big name to football fans. And at the time, I don't think I knew who he was, but I recently encountered another reference to him that kind of makes him a bit more contemporary. And so here is Walter Payton, a song about Walter Payton by the poet known as Riff Raff.
Goodbye, folks.
Sitting on Satan, sitting on some hot sapphires, got some diamonds. Andy Miller knockers got the bumper kid reclining. Me and B Nasty Paul Smith in the Shasta, talking so much that she damn the couch asthma. Me and T Rex, and I'm chilling with her nasty. Poet served in the Shasta, bitches wanna pass me. A screen's on, and I'm watching Walter Payton. Yeah, I said I'm watching Walter Payton, watching Walter Payton, and I'm sitting on Dayton's. My seat's so hot, I feel like I'm sitting on Satan. A screen's on, and I'm watching Walter Payton. Yeah, I said I'm watching Walter Payton. I said I'm watching Walter Payton. A screen's on and I'm watching Walter Payton. Should I go again in a drop top Benz? Brick score a century. Riff Raff ain't got some twins. I probably got some clones. Represent Acres home. 80 screens on and you know I stay on. Hopped out the Cougar car, you know I got an iPhone. Apple look like hologram, looking like a pizzeria. Bitches look like tortillas. His abs is working out. He working out like Jane Fonda doing Tybo. Bitches got some tidy shoes. I got a Taiwan African. That bitch is looking like she got some sapphire skin. They look like emeralds. Bitches gonna play with me. Hoes wanna date me and these bitches wanna skate on me. It's so much ice, got an icy device. Jesus Christ, yes my lord and my nice miss. Got a diamond on my neck and wrist. You don't believe me, take a piss. I got a bitch on the freezer. Bitches in Almeida, these hoes act like skeezers. Don't figure this is gay just cause we gon' beat ya. Yeah, we beat it up, syrup in the cup. Andy Miller, Niners got bourbon on these sluts. Yeah. and I bought like Walter Payton. Ace Cream's on, and I bought like Walter Payton. You playing football, should have had some Dayton. Ace Cream's on, and I'm Walter Payton.
Yeah. Walter Payton, on these dates we skating. Hold up, little mama, cause you know we ain't playing. Ripping dirt nasty, Andy Miller nasty. Yeah, I'm at your bitch door, I'm running through her pockets. What you talking about? I'll make you walk it out. Cool, Aid, sweet mouth, what you talk about? I ain't tripping cause you know we nasty doing shit. And these niggas mad cause they bitches really choosing, bitch.
Yes.
No,
I had to bring it.
What?
Yeah, we ball like Walter Payton. You know why I ball like Walter Payton?